are listening to the Tom and Curley Show. Tom Tangney here. John Curley called in sick this morning. We trust he's on the mend. And Felix Spinell is gracious enough to cover for him today. Again, thanks, Felix.
You bet.
So, I mentioned at the top of the show an hour ago how many big stories we have, and this is just another in a seemingly endless list of big stories. Today was the beginning or the start of the House investigation into the attack on the Capitol building on January 6th, and you had your first day of testimony. Now, just a quick little background. I'm sure John and I would go round and round on this, but I'm just going to kind of quickly run through what happened leading up to this in terms of the investigation. So originally, there was a call for a bipartisan commission that's based on the 9/11 commission, where I think Slade Gorton might even have been a former senator.
Yeah, I interviewed him about that, too. I was going to bring that up. I had a good long talk with him about his role in the 9/11 commission 20 years ago. So
excellent. Anyway, yeah, and it was balanced between, it was a very bipartisan. People, they took five on Democrats and five Republicans, and they were sort of like revered representatives of both parties doing the investigation. They came out. They didn't have a minority report or anything. That was the idea behind the call for bipartisan commission to investigate this. And the Republicans decided that they didn't want the investigation. They rejected the option. So then it was left to the political devices of the Democrats in charge. Pelosi decided, Nancy Pelosi, House Speaker, decided that she would have her own committee investigate it, and she named six Democrats and one Republican, and she told Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader, that he could name five, and he did, and then she rejected two of the five, Jim Jordan and Jim Banks. Jim Jordan, if you don't know him, is a real flamethrower. He loves to throw monkey wrenches into anything the Democrats want. Now, if you agree with his politics, you think that that's a worthy role. But he basically was challenging the very foundation of the need for an investigation. So she just thought it was highly unusual. But she said, no, those two people have come out. And Jim Banks from Indiana had called a press conference basically challenging the very notion that there needed to be an investigation of this sort run by, the Democrats. And so when she rejected two of the five suggested by McCarthy then turned around and said, okay, fine, you don't get any of them. And so he withdrew. The Republicans had no representation, at least through the minority leader's disposition. And at that point, Nancy Pelosi named a second Republican, Adam Kinzinger. If you know anything about who Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger are, they were two of the 10 who voted to impeach President Trump for the incitement of what happened on January 6th. Okay, all of that is just background. You can dispute it somewhat.
Could you repeat that one more time, please?
The facts are all out there. That's where everybody stands. So now, today was the first day of testimony, and we heard from four of the officers who were literally on the ground doing a battle with the protesters on the Capitol ground. So this first one, this is from Capitol Hill officer Harry Dunn, who says protesters repeatedly called him the N-word. He happens to be black.
One woman in a pink MAGA shirt yelled, "You hear that, guys? This voted for Joe Biden." Then the crowd, perhaps around 20 people, joined in screaming, "Boo!" No one had ever, ever called me a while wearing the uniform of a Capitol Police officer.
Yeah. And I heard that live on CNN.
Following the attempted insurrection, other black officers shared with me their own stories of racial abuse on January 6th. One officer told me he had never, and in his entire 40 years of life, been called a to his face, and that streak ended on January 6th. Yet another black officer later told me he had been confronted by insurrectionists in the Capitol who told him, "Put your gun down and we'll show you what kind of you really are."
Okay, so you were saying,
I stepped on that cut there. I heard that, they played that. I listened to that live on CNN this morning, and they played that, unbleeped, and they replayed it multiple times, unbleeped. First, not the first time I've heard those words on American media, and they have different rules on cable TV than they do on broadcast, of course. But it was really, by the second or third time I heard it, it was really starting to get to me. I don't know if that, it was sort of an accumulative effect. Like the first few times, it was just sort of, anyway, it's strange to hear those words unbleeped. And we've heard that a lot the last couple of years, words like that. There's been this whole sort of the S-hole countries kind of line that was crossed a couple of years ago. It's the way the language is adapting, is or the way the media is adapting to the this new the barrenness of the language is crazy, unheard of.
Okay. So, and here now is D.C. Metropolitan Police Officer Michael Fanone, who said nothing in his career prepared him for that day.
The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful. My law enforcement career prepared me to cope with some of the aspects of this experience. Being an officer, you know your life is at risk whenever you walk out the door. Even if you don't expect otherwise law-abiding citizens to take up arms against you. But nothing, truly nothing, has prepared me to address those elected members of our government who continue to deny the events of that day. And in doing so, betray their oath of office. Those very members whose lives, offices, staff members, I was fighting so desperately to defend. I agreed to speak here today and have talked publicly about what happened because I don't think our response to the insurrection should have anything to do with political parties.
Okay, let's go through the, we've got two more clips. This one is from Capitol Police. So again, if anyone needs clarification, there's the Capitol Police and then there's the DC Metropolitan Police Officers. First one we heard from was a Capitol Police officer. This, that one was a Metropolitan Police Officer. This one's another Capitol Police Sergeant, Gonnell said the events of January 6th were more terrifying than his combat deployment.
When I was 25 years old and then a sergeant in the Army, I had deployed to Iraq. From time to time, I volunteered to travel on IED-infested roads to conduct supply missions for U.S. and allied forces and local Iraqi population as well. But on January 6th, for the first time, I was more afraid to work at the Capitol than my entire deployment to Iraq.
And then he went on to say he, at one point, he thought he was going to die.
What we were suggested that day was like something from a medieval battle. We fought hand to hand, inch by inch, to prevent an invasion of the Capitol by a violent mob intent on subverting our democratic process. I vividly heard officers screaming in agony and pain just an arm length from me. I, too, was being crushed by the rioters. I could feel myself losing oxygen and recall thinking to myself, this is how I'm going to die, defending this entrance.
Okay, so this was the firsthand testimony. Clearly, they selected four people for, you know, for most dramatic effect, I'm assuming. You saw a bunch of this hearing. What was the overall impression? Did it feel like they were, I don't know, convincing? Imagine if put yourself in the position of someone like John, who has, I think, has kind of poo-pooed this insurrection as like not that big a deal. They were misdirected. They weren't, you know, armed. They didn't, you know, shoot anybody and all this. That it, to call it an insurrection is too much. Do you think this kind of testimony would change anybody's mind? Do you think it was effective in bringing to light what it felt like to be on the front lines? What were your overall impressions? Just emotionally.
I mean, it's really we're really in sort of an age of political theater lately, whether it's spontaneous political theater like January 6th or, you know, depending how much planning went into it, or this more calculated political theater that kind of reminded me a little bit of the two impeachment proceedings in the past couple of years. I thought the officers were all really solid. There was one guy who spoke, he spoke at length. He didn't really say stuff that was necessarily soundbite worthy. It's a guy named Daniel Hodges. He did this sort of blow by blow about like the time they arrived, they pull up in the vehicle, you know, at 7:09, we walked across the street, and then you noticed a group of men responding a block away. He kind of went through it blow by blow, and it made me think about, you know, what Slade Gordon had told me when I talked to him probably 10 years ago about the 9/11 Commission. Slade Gordon, former U.S. Senator from Washington, recently deceased. Anyway, he said that, you know, the recommendations of that very, very partisan people on that group on the 9/11 Commission, partisan on each side, but they came together to do a nonpartisan or a bipartisan report and study. And he said, you know, the recommendations will get dated. Most of it's going to be anachronistic, but as long as we get the history right, if we come up with a timeline and a narrative that we can all agree to, then we will have done our jobs as commissioners. And I've read that a few times from that report that was came out in 2004. It is a really chilling, solid account, kind of blow-by-blow timeline of what happened and where in terms of the different jets that were hijacked, when they hit the different towers, when they hit the Pentagon and the response. And it is really, you know, it was agreed to by both sides.
Mm-hmm.
It would be, you know, I sort of, part of me missed Jim Jordan today. Because I missed him hectoring or badgering these guys with some inane comment about something unrelated to the actual topic at hand, but that would have given the proceedings a bigger imprimatur of actual bipartisanship. I mean, this is bipartisan. I get that. I get it's a select committee that the Republicans chose not to be part of.
Yeah.
That Nancy Pelosi got Kinzinger and Cheney to take part in. But it was missing that element of those badgering, hectoring, not loyal opposition, but the opposition who could kind of give it more of a... less political theater, less of a calculated thing to make an impression on people.
Your wish is my command. So we do have afterwards the Republican leaders held a press conference, and we can hear from Elise Stefanik. But before we do that, since you invoked the name of Jim Jordan, who was promoted and then demoted off the committee, he has an interesting. I don't know who a person to blame or something to blame. Let's hear what he has to say about who really should be held responsible.
When you spend a year talking about defunding the police and actually defund the police, it's kind of hard to have more police here on January 6th like they should have done. That's the fundamental question. That's why this thing has turned into such a political charade. The police officers who will testify today, and frankly, all Capitol Hill police officers, deserve to have more help that day. But the Democrats couldn't do it because of the political position they had taken all throughout last year. That's the fundamental question that won't be answered. That's why Republicans aren't serving on this committee.
So blame the fire truck, not the arsonist? Is that what that is?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Jim Jordan that I admire as much as I can't stand him politically is that he's absolutely shameless. Yeah, so there should be more people to back, you know, to back down the onrushing hordes of people who were using Jim Jordan as a rallying cry for why they should not validate the election. And again, just to show how fair I am, let's also hear from Elise Stefanik. Now, the reason this is significant is Elise Stefanik is the Republican legislator, lawmaker, who replaced Liz Cheney in leadership when Liz Cheney refused to play along with the Republican leadership vis-a-vis Donald Trump and the insurrection investigation.
It is a fact that in December of 2020, Nancy Pelosi was made aware of potential security threats to the Capitol, and she failed to act. It is a fact that the U.S. Capitol Police raised concerns, and rather than providing them with the support and resources they needed and they deserved, she prioritized her partisan political optics over their safety. The American people deserve to know the truth that Nancy Pelosi bears responsibility as Speaker of the House for the tragedy that occurred on January 6th. And it was only after Republicans started asking these important questions that she refused to seat them.
Okay, and now let's hear from who she replaced, Elise Stefanik. This is Liz Cheney, why she thinks it's important to have this commission, even if it is run mostly, or investigation run by mostly Democrats.
If those responsible are not held accountable, and if Congress does not act responsibly, this will remain a cancer on our constitutional republic, undermining the peaceful transfer of power at the heart of our democratic system. We will face the threat of more violence in the months to come and another January 6th every 4 years.
Okay, and then finally, Adam Kinzinger. Again, Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney are on the outs in the Republican Party. They are both fervent conservative Republicans, but on this score, they are dead set against the vast majority of Republicans in taking the what happened on January 6th seriously. So this is Adam Kinzinger reacting to the testimony of the officers.
I think it's important to tell you right now, though. You guys may, like, individually feel a little broken. You guys all talk about the effects you have to deal with, and, you know, you talk about the impact of that day. But you guys won. You guys held. You know, democracies are not defined by our bad days. We're defined by how we come back from bad days, how we take accountability for that. And for all the overheated rhetoric surrounding this committee, our mission is very simple. It's to find the truth, and it's to ensure accountability. Like most Americans, I'm frustrated that 6 months after a deadly insurrection breached the United States Capitol for several hours on live television, we still don't know exactly what happened. Why? Because many in my party have treated this as just another partisan fight.
Okay. Anyway, that's enough. That's if you haven't had a chance to watch the proceedings, I hope that those clips gave you a good sense of what day one in this investigation looked like. Okay. Sorry, Tracy, for getting so late to you. How's traffic? You're listening to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here. Felix Bunnell filling in for an ailing John Curly. He unexpectedly called in sick, and Felix rushed to the front of the line. We really appreciate the suddenness of your availability.
Wait till the show's over and thank me for doing a good job. Don't thank me now. I might have to back out from too much pressure, being under too much pressure to perform another gold medal level broadcast.
Nice segue. I didn't realize that you were the goat of all guest hosting slots. But, yes, Aaron mentioned it just briefly in his newscast. I talked about it at the beginning of the show how many, you know, big news stories we have. And this is one of the biggest. The sort of just acknowledged GOAT of her sport, the greatest gymnast ever, Simone Biles, who was the lock of all locks in the Olympics, withdrew from today or last night or wherever, whatever time it was in tomorrow in Japan. It is so confusing. In fact, you told me, what I do is I just turn on NBC and just see what's available, but they have all these different platforms. You can see something streaming, you see something's on Peacock, something's on network television. That you were telling me that the gymnast team competition, which is what we're talking about, you could watch it live this morning and then tonight sort of do a recap or something?
That's my understanding, because I think Japan is 16 hours ahead of us here. So, I mean, to end the confusion, I watched The Bachelorette last night instead. Didn't worry about the Olympics.
So, too bad that hasn't been dropped. But, okay, so what's the story? What are y'all talking about? So it was big news, actually. Yesterday's big news was that the overwhelming favorite, the women's gymnastics team from the United States of America, which had won, I think, 3 straight gold medals, mm-hmm. had come in. Wasn't leading. I think they were second or maybe even third, but I think probably second in the preliminaries, which doesn't mean anything. You throw all numbers out. No one was really that concerned, but we had a couple of uncharacteristic slips or mistakes. Well, this time out in the team competition, after Simone Biles did one kind of iffy vault, which, as they say, an iffy vault from Simone Biles is still like the best in the world. But she ended up withdrawing from the rest of the competition. Absolutely fascinating and stunning. Think of this. You're on a team. Now, it's an individualized sport, but you're on a team. Imagine the anchor, the person that so best represents you and your profession, gymnastics, suddenly pulls out. You then have to continue with the competition knowing that Simone is not there. This is Simone Biles explaining why she dropped out during a press conference. She dropped out right after the kind of the iffy vault.
I just felt like it would be a little bit better to take a back seat, work on my mindfulness, and I knew that the girls would do an absolutely great job, and I didn't want to risk the team a medal for kind of my screw-ups because they've worked way too hard for that. So I just decided that those girls need to go in and do the rest of the competition.
Okay, so that I like that clip because it doesn't mention the mental health. She does mention the mindfulness, but this was in that clip, a calculation, a strategic calculation that if she just wasn't feeling it, that if she continued, her scores would actually drag down the other girls, as she put it, scores. And so it was, I don't know if you could say it's an act of selflessness, but it was an act of what's best for the team. They might do better without her, which I think most of us would agree was unlikely, but perhaps true to form. What do you think about her explanation at that level?
Well, I wonder if because of this, will she be remembered for this, for sort of bowing down, bowing out at the before the team competition? I mean, she's proven she's the greatest gymnast, right? She's won multiple gold medals and over multiple different Olympics. So it wasn't like there was anything left for her to prove. Yeah. Throw in the fact that Biles and everybody else has had to wait a year for these Olympics to happen. And even as recently as a week ago, there was still uncertainty as to whether or not the plug might get pulled on the whole thing.
Yeah.
Now, I'm no Olympic athlete, Tom. I'm sure it comes as a shock. But I know a huge part of it.
You barely know how to spell sports.
It's 90% mental and 90%. But I mean, there's some Yogi Berra quote that would be funny if I could remember it about the mental part of sports, right? Especially at this incredibly high level. And with the way things are in this new kind of woke world where everybody talks about their feelings and, you know, does what's best for them. And I mean, in some ways, it's a super selfish what's best for her move. But I don't think she's pretending that she thinks it's the best thing for the team, too. If it's not there for her, I would believe what she said, because she's obviously done it so many times before. And she's like right in the most intense pressure of a competition. And it doesn't affect her at all. It gave those chances, those other three teammates, to step up. If they'd gotten the gold, think how those guys would be just mega heroes. I mean, silver's not terrible. I mean, who am I? Again, I'm not an Olympic athlete, Tom. Stop saying that I am, okay? But it just...
Well,
that's what they say.
It's remarkable that the team still got a silver with the best on that team stepping away. And suddenly, you get this. So I think there's the three or four people on the team. They do these different routines. And two of these people had to do routines that they weren't planning on doing in the Olympics. Now, they're gymnasts and they do this I keep saying for a living. I mean, it's a sort of a living.
It's like me filling in on this show. I thought this afternoon I'd be working on a writing project, editing a video.
Right.
But no, here I am talking to you about Simone
Biles.
So look at me. Yeah, silver medal.
God knows you're not going to win a silver medal for today's performance. I guess it remains to be seen. But let's
not my mindfulness.
When this first happened, by the way, there was a lot of question. Oh, she looked like she might have injured herself. She was quick to say it had nothing to do with the injury. We don't need to play that clip. But let's get this last thing about her talking about the importance of mental health. We might have just heard this at the bottom of the hour, but let's hear her once again.
Yeah, I say put mental health first, because if you don't, then you're not going to enjoy your sport and you're not going to succeed as much as you want to. So it's okay sometimes to even sit out the big competitions to focus on yourself, because it shows how strong of a competitor and person that you really are, rather than just battle through it.
So that really is an interesting comment. As soon as I heard this morning, I thought, wow, this is Naomi Osaka. Naomi Osaka, one of the world's best tennis players, dropped out after, for mental health reasons. She was being docked, I think it was the French Open, and she did not want to do a press conference because she just felt like she just wasn't in the right mental space to do a press conference. Well, they fined her, I don't know if it was $1,000 or $5,000 or something, after which she just says, I'm not up to this. I'm not in the mental state. And everyone was just surprised that no one walked away from something like that. And suddenly they did. And Naomi Osaka got a lot of support from a lot of the players because of that.
Yeah, I've seen this with a lot of kids in college in the last year, questioning the value of their the degree they've chosen and whether it's worth even going to college. And like, it's sort of, COVID has kind of taken everything off the table in terms of what you really want to do, how you want to spend your life, how you want to spend your time.
Yeah. And then the other question, I think you raise a fascinating one. Will she be remembered for this? as much as she will be remembered for her greatness. One of the things we don't know, the future of the Olympics is still for her is still up in the air. They're going to say they're going to take it day by day. So she still could go for an individual, you know, all around gold. I mean, there's still plenty of opportunities for her to win something. The question is, if she will compete. But your suggestion, will this haunt her reputation? It's a bit like, you know, the No Mas fight, where in this big fight, about halfway through the fight, the fighter just said, you know, enough already. I'm not for this. His reputation took a hit for walking away. And yet I think that you call it woke. I don't know if it's really a wokeness, but this idea, attentiveness to mental health, is a factor. And maybe if athletes were more allowed to perform this way or not perform, they would have healthier lives. Who knows? I'm not an Olympic athlete either.
Really? I think everybody we're getting to a point where everyone is less willing to tolerate, you know, abuse or like self-deprivation or like self-destruction to try to get to some crazy goal, whether it's an Olympic gold medal or whether it's, you know, stumbling through a four-hour talk show.
By the way, she's the sole remaining sexual abuse victim in the U.S. gymnastics Larry Nassar tragedy to continue to perform. So, abuse is definitely something that should be and has been addressed in that arena. Okay, very good. I think I'll stay tuned and watch tonight's Olympics wrap-up to just see how that played out and what the general scuttlebutt is. Okay, Tracy Taylor, on the roads, things are looking decent, if not great. You're listening to the Tom and Curley Show. Tom Dangney here. John Curley out sick, and Felix Minnell filling in. You know, whenever we have a fill-in host, we figure like we need to throw them a bone to get them interested in filling in for us. And this next story, I think, fits the bill for Felix Minnell. The headline is: archivist sneezes on priceless document. Then what? And I figured, who would more want to talk about archival mishaps than our own archival mishap, Felix Minnell? Felix, you want to take it away, what this story is about and the kind of fears that you and your fellow leanings, you know, live in fear of?
Yeah, and it's about how archivists are oftentimes find themselves alone in rooms leaning over these one-of-a-kind only copies of certain documents, whether they're letters from a famous author or some treaty or something from 100 years ago or 300, 400 years ago. And just the weird power you feel. And I've felt this myself. I started working at Mohai about 20 years ago. And I remember like just kind of being allowed to kind of dig around through the library and pull stuff off the
shelves. So Mohai, in case you don't know Mohai, Museum of History and Industry.
Yeah. It used to be down in the Montlake neighborhood. Now it's over at the south, at South Lake Union. I was there about 20 years ago. I was there for about 7 years.
Yeah.
And I had that same sense of like, wow, look at this, all this stuff that the general public can't get their hands on. And here I could rub my hands all over this stuff. I could take it out and juggle these pieces of Arthur Denny's, you know, shaving kit or whatever.
Yeah.
And a lot of the horror stories in here, like a guy has a nosebleed and blood drips out of his nose onto this rare parchment paper, which is really hard to clean, right?
Yeah.
I was trying to think of times where I had stuff like this. I can't remember actually destroying anything.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that I did this big oral history project with Washington State University and had all these cassettes of interviews with people who worked in radio going back into the 1920s.
Sure. Wow.
And my job was to set up my little digital deck and my old tape recorder, you know, cassette player, play these tapes and record the digital sound so we'd have a digital copy of them.
Sure.
And some of these tapes were so old. I don't know if you remember how old cassette tapes, they weren't exactly built to last, and they're mechanical. A lot of moving parts and a lot of little bits of glue and little things.
Yep.
And so I would, you know, press play or whatever, and like, you know, I'd hear the first part of the oral history where it's the scratchy sound and the guy's introducing himself, and I'd get up and go do something. I don't know, go check something else, look out the window. I don't know what it would do. Come back, and it's like, wait, you put your headphones on. There's no sound coming out of the digital player, but the tape didn't stop, and you look down, and it's rotating, but there's nothing moving anymore because the tape is broken. And it's all wound up, and it's all crunched into like an accordion shape, like a bird's nest. And you have to take it apart. You have to, hopefully it's the kind that unscrews. If not, you have to crack it open if it's glued together. And you have to carefully, painstakingly flatten it out and then tape it back together and then start all over again and not destroy this one-of-a-kind sound of this old broadcaster talking about working in radio in the 1930s.
You know, this is funny. I hadn't thought of that until you just mentioned it. But so among my family members, like about four brothers, I'm the one that's most interested in keeping historical records. And I remember my great aunt and uncle, Bob and Elizabeth. This was, you know, they must have been in their late 80s, early 90s. And I was getting their recollections about this old cabin because they were the ones that helped build it on Whidbey Island in the 1931, 32. Huh. And I recorded this this interview, and then I took it home, and I think I went to make a recording of the recording, and I ended up erasing it. So now, luckily, they hadn't died in the intervening days, and so I had to go back and do the same dang interview.
It wasn't as good though the second time around. No, like, we told you this already, Tommy. Exactly. Tommy, I told you. I came in the house. Yeah.
Very good. Okay, well, that's it for archival history today. And now we'll turn to speaking of today, traffic today with Tracy Taylor.